Lecture S-41, April 8, 1963, Flow of Wet Water. Lecture S-41, April 8, 1963, Flow of Wet Water.
I have so much to talk about today, and as usual, the same amount of time. I'd like to take advantage of you and ask you, please, if I see I'm not finished at the end, to wait, but I guarantee to be finished within 5 minutes of the end. I mean, after fun, sorry. At any moment, there's only 5 minutes more. Last time we discussed the behavior of water, disregarding the phenomena of viscosity, and today we would like to discuss the phenomena of the flow of fluids, including the effects of viscosity and the real behavior of the fluids. In this lecture, I will describe only qualitatively the actual behavior of the fluids under different circumstances so that you will get some feel for the subject. It is not meant in any way as something, I have many equations and lots of complicated things to talk about. It is not my purpose that you should learn all these things, but it's in a sense of a cultural lecture which gives you some idea of the way the world is. There's only one item which is worth learning, and that is the simple definition of viscosity, which I'll come to in a moment. It's on the bottom board here. This is elementary enough that we'll learn that. But the rest of it is only for your entertainment. Before I have so much to talk about, I hope I can do it. The reason I have so much is that I want to make a clear picture of the complexities, and the subject, the actual thing, is complex enough that it takes many words to describe. Before I do so, however, before I begin, I would like to review from last time what we found out for the theory of the flow. We discovered that the laws of motion would be given by this equation. If we take incompressible flow, the divergence of a velocity is zero. We supposed first that the forces of viscosity and that there were no other, that viscosity was not considered, and other forces, we supposed there are no other forces that other than those that can be obtained from a potential. And then we found by taking the curl of the equation that the second equation was correct. Now, it was not obvious, but I stated that the content, the physical content of this equation is that if you draw lines of the vorticity, lines in which you're always parallel to the twisting axis of the liquid, that those lines would move with the fluid, and that the vorticity would be carried about in the fluid. I would like to explain that this fact is really, although it's complicated to derive this way, can be partially understood. It is a consequence of it's really the law of conservation of angular momentum applied to the fluid. And just as a simple example, I take this. Suppose that these are the vortex lines, the material is circulating here, and that this is a little cylinder made of vortex lines which has a certain small radius A and a certain height. Now, during the flow, we'll suppose that the cylinder is squashed to a new dimension. It may be twisted and so forth, but just for a moment, just suppose it's only squashed in a new direction to a new radius, A prime, and that the amount of vorticity in here is omega and the amount here omega prime. Now, the situation is that of course, the height is higher because the volume has to be the same. Now, the situation is that if we, for a moment, cut out this little piece of fluid and see what forces are acting on it, we see that they're only due to pressure. And they're always normal to the surface. Therefore, there's no torque applied to the fluid. And so, as it is squashed into a new dimension, it has to speed up its angular velocity, much as the famous skater who pulls in arms, in order to keep the angular momentum, which is the moment of inertia, times the angular velocity of the fluid, which is proportional to omega, by a factor 2, in fact, constant. Now, the moment of inertia of a given mass of material is proportional to the square of the radius, and therefore we have that this is true. In other words, the vorticity times the area is the same on both cases. But that's precisely what you would expect if the vortex lines were kept in the fluid. For the vorticity is measured by the number of lines per unit area. If the vorticity here is higher, the number of lines per unit area is higher, But the area is smaller, and the number of lines in total, which is the vorticity times the area, is the same. So you see that the fact that the vortex lines stay in the fluid, and as this is squashed, they simply get more dense, is a consequence of the conservation of angular momentum, and that's the meaning of this equation. Also, I would like to explain a little bit about the vortex ring which we produced by hitting this thing. It was a situation in which all the vorticity was concentrated in a small region in the shape of a cylindrical ring. And in order to find the velocity produced at any moment by that vorticity, we have to solve a pair of equations. One, the divergence of V is equal to zero, and the other, which is the definition of vorticity, which I forgot to write down, which is that the vorticity is the curl of V. Given omega, we have to find V. Those equations are just the same as the equations for finding a magnetic field from a current density equal to omega. And if this represents an electric current going around in that direction, the vorticity, that is, then the magnetic field that's produced by such a current is, say, this way here. I don't know the sign. Yes, right. This way here. And from the down current on the other side is also this way here. It's this way on every point on the, among others, there's lots of other velocities in other places, but at least on the ring, all the velocities, all the magnetic fields are parallel. All the velocities are parallel. And now comes a statement which is different than the laws of electricity. This is the laws of electricity, this and this. But this statement now says that the vorticity moves at the velocity of the fluid there. And we've just proved that there's a velocity everywhere, and so the ring must move. It moves itself along. However, the region of vorticity stays put in here. What you have, of course, is a motion where things are going around this way. That's the actual motion and the whole thing moving forward. Now, we notice from this equation here that if omega is equal to zero initially, it'll always be zero. And this shows the great failure of the whole situation because it is impossible, it says, to produce any vorticity in any circumstance. Yet you saw a smoke ring. Or you remember when I started that great whirlpool, I put a paddle in and stirred the fluid. Everybody knows you stir the fluid with a paddle. You make vorticity with a paddle. Yet according to this equation, if omega is initially zero, it's always zero. And it is impossible to stir your tea, according to that equation. That, therefore, is incorrect, and we have to go further. There's also one other feature which is incorrect here, which is correlated, as a matter of fact. When we discuss, for example, the flow past a cylinder and solve the equations, we permitted there to be a flow right at the surface of the cylinder. That is, that between the interface between a solid and a liquid, it is assumed in the potential flow theory that the velocity need not be zero, and that there's no sort of friction between the solid and the liquid. It turns out, although it is not absolutely self-evident, that one of the conditions of liquid flow in all circumstances that have been experimentally verified is that the velocity of the fluid is exactly zero right at solid surfaces. The great fan, for example, which is used to run a wind tunnel, I noticed once, it was dusty, so I marked it with an X with my fingers. They turned on the fan, they ran it for a while, turned it off, and there was still the X in the dust. Because in spite of the fact the fan is going around, the velocity of fluid right at the surface of the fan is small enough under those circumstances that the little particles of dust were not lifted off, in spite of the speed at which the fan was going. So at any rate, the velocity at the surface is exactly zero. I won't discuss the reason because I don't understand it. Certainly, if the liquid is glass and it's held in a steel box, you can make it slide, all right. So there must be a limit to this. However, nobody has experimentally with ordinary liquidy liquids, unlike glass, have gotten themselves into trouble from assuming V equals zero at the surface. So this solution is impossible, and furthermore, we can't stir, so it's all wrong. And we have now to discuss the next feature, which must be included in the description of water flow, and that is the viscosity. A new phenomenon is involved here. We already denoted that when we put, that the liquid is characterized by the fact that if you put a shearing force on, it gives, no matter how weak the shearing force, perhaps slowly, but after an equilibrium is set in, the shearing force is completely reduced. But before equilibrium is set in, while you're still pushing on it, it gives. And if you want to have a measure of the gooiness of honey, or the thickness of it relative, say, to water, we need to consider the following kind of experiment. Suppose that we have two planes with water in between, and we try to push one relative to the other at a given velocity. It turns out, then, that the force is not zero needed to do that, even in equilibrium, because as you drag the fluid, if the fluid is thick, there's a force required. The force per unit area is the thing that's independent of the dimensions of this thing, and it turns out is proportional to the velocity, in fact, to the rate at which the velocity changes with vertical distance. In other words, the velocity divided by the vertical distance and the force per unit area are proportional, and the constant of proportionality is called eta, the viscosity. And mathematically, for this expression, for this case, we would call it dv sub x dy, if you want a more elegant form. Actually, to be precise, this is the shearing stress, and it isn't dv sub x dy, but the sum of these two to avoid the case of rotation. There's no energy needed to just turn a fluid, it's only to shear a fluid. You see that the difference between elastic stresses related to distortions and these stresses is that in elasticity, the forces depend upon the shear displacements which you've produced, while here they depend upon how fast you're doing the shearing. If you try to shear it faster, you require more force. Then that's the characteristic of viscosity, and this part of the lesson over here is one which I hope that you could learn well, while the rest of it we only have to understand vaguely. I consider as an example of application of this the motion of fluid between two coaxial cylinders. In fact, we have a piece of apparatus to demonstrate later, with two coaxial cylinders, one rotating inside the other, or perhaps both rotating. Let us suppose that this represents a cross-section, a cross-section through the cylinders. The inside radius is A with a velocity VA, the outside radius is B with velocity VB, and they're moving slightly different than the plane. Problem is, what is the distribution of velocity inside? How fast does the velocity vary with radius? All in this equation, the radius is a cylindrical variable, not a spherical variable, please. Now, let's suppose we draw a radius R. Then, at this point here, the shear stress, the stress across that surface, is eta times the rate of change of the velocity, which I'm going to suppose is all around, as mutual, I think it's called, dv dr. Is the rate of change of this velocity vertical. This is the differential form of the statement above and is the definition of the viscosity. Now, however, we have the dynamic fact that if this is a steady motion, that the shears, that the torque, let's talk about the torque which is required to maintain the rotation of the inside cylinder. We have to apply a certain torque, and that torque must be carried through that surface. If we multiply the shear stress by the area, and then by the radius of the lever arm, in other words, of the force, this makes the force and this makes the torque, that this is the torque, and this torque is constant for all the radii in the steady condition. That gives us an equation then, that eta dv dr is equal to the shear stress, which is the torque divided by r squared, which is very easily integrated, and this gives 1 over r squared being 1 over r, and I integrated it starting from the radius A where V must be VA, and this is integral, this tells how the velocity varies, and then we can solve it back, put the boundary condition at the other surface, and find the relation between the torque and the velocities, and thus, for example, have an instrument for measuring the coefficient of viscosity by measuring the torque needed to turn one cylinder inside another, and so on. It's just an example of the theory, and you can do other simple examples. However, it's interesting to have some numbers for application. It's convenient for other purposes to divide the coefficient of viscosity by the density, and I happen to remember the numbers for the ratio of the coefficient of viscosity for the divided by the density, and it's 10 to the minus 6 times meters squared per second, that is in the MKS system, for water at 20 degrees centigrade. It is very sensitive to the temperature. It varies very much. It's nearly 1.8 times bigger at the freezing point, of just above the freezing point. Eta over rho is equal to about 15 or 16 times the same amount for air at 20 degrees. And that gives you some numbers to get an idea of the effect. Now I would like to discuss, now we leave the simplicity and we go to the general. We discuss the general theory of viscosity according to the highest form known to man. So we change ourselves from the simple to the sublime to the more ridiculous. Anyway, here's a stress tensor to measure the stresses in any circumstance. And we already understand that how this stress is related to the rate of change of the velocities, as this is just the same equation as that I had written over here. However, it turns out that the stresses are not only dependent upon the rate of shearing, but also other components of the change in velocity. There are two coefficients of viscosity which relate the stress and the rate of change of strain, which is the analog of the two elastic constants which relate stress and strain. The only difference is that we have rate of change of strain, velocities, instead of displacements in these equations. So there really are two coefficients of viscosity, which I have, I don't know what the name of them are, but I call one eta and the other eta prime. Now we can obtain the force acting on an element in a viscous fluid, which we need for our equations. And if this is the shear at one surface and this is the shear at another, it's the difference of these two that constitutes the force. So the forces depend upon the rates of change of the shears with distances, and therefore on the second derivatives of the velocity. Now it gets easy again because we're back to vectors. You see that there are two forms of second derivatives which can be compounded of vectors, the Laplacian and the divergence gradient of the divergence. We already pointed out that the curl of the curl is the relation when we did elasticity. So the most general formula is that there's some coefficient of the Laplacian and some other coefficient of the gradient of the divergence. Most people don't even know of the existence of the second term in viscosity because most people have dealt with incompressible fluids or those which are nearly incompressible, for which the divergence of V is equal to zero, in which case this term is of no significance and only the second term is important in the theory of the motion of most fluids below the speed of sound. In calculating, however, the absorption of sound in a fluid in which you have volume changes, then it is necessary to take into account the second coefficient of viscosity. All information, free information. The world is complicated, and as I have to tell you what it's like, I cannot help that fact that it's complicated. Now, we put this law, which is very simple, into the equations of hydrodynamics here for the viscous force. I suppose that there are no other forces, again. And then if we take the curl of both sides, we have a new equation by taking the curl of this, which is eta over rho, times the Laplacian of omega. Now let us look at our equation. This would say, if this were zero, that the viscosity, vorticity stays with the fluid. But it isn't zero, so the vorticity doesn't stay with the fluid where it was before. Like the smoke which came out of there carried along with the vorticity because it stays in the same fluid. But in narrow, the vorticity doesn't change, but it has a complicated term over here. But even this one is easy to understand. If for a moment we move with the fluid at a given place so that the V is zero, well, that's not accurate, but suppose for a moment we disregard this term to understand the equation. Then this was a diffusion equation. This says that the omega diffuses. If there's a large gradient, a lot of omega here and not much omega here in two places in the fluid, that the omega gradually diffuses into the remainder of the fluid. I would like to give a demonstration of the diffusion of vorticity, which requires that Mr. Harvey assist me by smoking his pipe. We're going to do the following. From this, there comes a vortex ring as before. And it is no smoke in the box. And so it has carrying clean air. Now, as it goes through a mess of smoke, which Harvey will create here, the vorticity is spreading into the other air and picks up some of the smoke. And so the vortex ring, which comes out over here, should be, and maybe you can see it and maybe you can't, it's very hard to see, a ring with a hollow center. a ring of smoke with the clean air on the inside, because it picked up the smoke as the vorticity was spreading as it goes through the smoke. That's what we should see, and we'll see if we do see. Oh, I'm sorry, the light is so bright I thought it was on. Could it come a little closer? Yeah. Does it look hollow at the other end? I can't see from here. I've got to get aimed right. Put some more smoke, Doc. How's it working? Is it making? Well, that's the best I can do anyway. We happened to notice it when we were doing the other experiment, and you see that it has picked up some of the air as the vorticity spreads from the original small circle, but the inside still keeps the ordinary clean air. I have burned holes. There are holes burned in the paper here. Now I'm going to describe the changes which are made in the character of the flow as produced by the term in vorticity, in the viscosity. And the first problem, there are two problems that we will discuss at great length. The first is the flow of liquid past the cylinder, a flow which we have previously calculated by potential theory. Well, we didn't calculate it, we discussed it. We've done the case of the sphere by potential theory, a very simple flow. We'd act very easy. We even had a demonstration of it. We'd now like to discuss what the flow around the cylinder is according to the equations. It turns out the equations cannot be solved by man today in all circumstances, but in some he can. And I have to, in order to describe it, tell you the results of actual experiments, presuming that the experimental world satisfies this equation. Then I'm talking about the solutions of that equation. So to put the problem mathematically, I would like to say that the problem of the flow past a cylinder of a certain diameter is to solve the following mathematical problem. It's a mathematics, nothing else. The divergence is zero, the curl is omega of the velocity. The omega satisfies this equation, copied off of the board over here. Now we have to finish the complete statement of the problem so the mathematician can take over who knows no physics, that V is equal to zero at the surface of the cylinder. This is a cylindrical radius, square root of x squared plus y squared. And I'm using diameters instead of radii because I have to compare it to slides made by engineers who like diameters instead of radii. Now we have the other boundary condition that at infinity the velocity shall be u, a uniform speed moving past the cylinder in the z direction, say. I'm sorry, our cylinder is the square root of z squared plus. Let's just be the z direction. You figure out the other axes. And it's a mess, the act, but I got this wrong. Anyway, V sub x equals 0 and V sub y equals 0. There's a uniform flow at velocity u at infinity. Now, if you look at this, you see that there are three parameters in the problem. And in order to describe the experimental results, I will have to give you, you would think I would have to give you a whole series of cases. Different diameters, different velocities, and different liquids, each giving a different value of eta over rho, d, and u. However, it is not the case. The different cases can be easily related to only one parameter. And this is a very important point, which I can't expect you to follow in these particular equations, except the general idea. Suppose that we try to change the scales of length so that, for example, all x, y, and z are given by d times some other variable, x prime, y prime, and z prime. Then the radius of the cylinder, r equal d over 2, will correspond now to the x, y, z, the prime, r prime, equals 1 half, which is a number and no longer one of the variables. You see. In the same way, if we let all velocities be the velocity at infinity times v prime, then v prime will equal 1 at infinity, and we have removed that other parameter. As a consequence of these two substitutions, you see that omega, which is a derivative, or the gradient, rather, which is 1 over x, is 1 over d gradient prime, and omega, coming from the curl of v, would therefore u over d omega prime. And so you can find a number of these different terms and substitute it in all the terms of the equations. But the hope, however, is that the various terms will have all their coefficients match. In order to do that, you'll find that the time must be changed by d over u times t prime, so that the changes in this term will both be the same, and will both be, well, it's hard, a velocity, an omega, and the gradient here, you see, 1 over d. So this side of the equation here will be multiplied by this constant. The other side of the equation will be multiplied by 1 over d square times an omega, which is u over d. And when you put this coefficient on the other side, you get the following equation, these equations. Everything the same as that, except by dividing all these constants, I have sucked all the constants into one. This constant written here as 1 over r, this r is u, turns out to be ud over eta over rho. This number is called the Reynolds number for the problem. And the situation we can deduce is the following, that our mathematical problem is now given in the pink square, which is to solve these equations with an r as a variable, unknown, I mean a constant, which is different in different problems. But in every problem, the velocity is 0 at r equals a half, and the velocity is 1 at infinity. Now, this physical thing that's implied by this is very interesting. It means that if we were to do the problem of a flow at one velocity with one diameter cylinder with one fluid, and then take a different diameter cylinder at a different velocity with a different fluid, provided we arrange only that the velocity, say, is so adjusted in the second case that the r is the same, then the flow in the one case should be exactly the same, only in proportion in the scale, in time and in space, as given by these laws, as it is in the other case. This is a very important proposition because it means that we can figure out the behavior of the flow of fluids past a wing or a complicated airplane, not by building the airplane and blowing it through the air at 600 miles an hour, well, say 400 miles an hour, no, say 200 miles an hour. I have to watch out because I have to get below the speed of sound because I have an incompressible approximation here. But instead, we can take a smaller model and use a different fluid and a different speed, and we make wind tunnels or water tunnels to imitate the behavior of the air, and we can just deduce by experiment for the behavior of the air around an airplane on a small model of the airplane instead of the whole big thing. Anyway, for our purposes, we just have to do a cylinder. It turns out, in fact, that this fact is very well verified. One must watch out. I have left out compressibility. If you have a situation where compressibility is important, a new velocity, the velocity of sound, comes in and you can't scale that away, more terms don't balance anymore, and you need also to make sure that the velocity you're using, the velocity that you're using over the speed of sound is the same in both cases. That's called the Mach number, and in order to, when you're getting near the speed of sound or above, you must make sure that both the Reynolds number and the Mach number are equal for the two situations. But if we're way below the speed of sound, then we don't have to worry about the Mach number as long as it's small. All right, then, we now discuss the results of experiment on the case of the flow past a cylinder. This is a completely qualitative description of the actual behavior of true wet water or air or any other liquid, except liquid helium. Now, first, to give some idea of where we're going, I draw here a picture of a curve which represents, which represents the drag force on the cylinder. If I measure one thing, there are a lot of things you can measure, but one thing you can measure, how much resistance the cylinder offers to the flow. And then if we change the speed by increasing from very low to very high speed, CR is proportional to the speed, then we find a high coefficient, the high force. Actually, it's written this way. They happen to have divided the actual force by this combination in order to get a dimensionless coefficient of drag. And the coefficient of drag varies in a rather complicated way, giving us a pre-hint that something is happening in a rather interesting and complicated way in the actual flow of the fluid. I'll show the actual graph rather than my hand drawing in the first slide. This, then, is the way it actually looks, and these experiments only go up to here. The other curve we wouldn't need to worry about. It's just another indication that things are changing from one condition to another. I'll now describe, if I might, the flow of the fluid in the different circumstances. May I have the lights, please? First, when the Reynolds number is very small, the flow qualitatively looks is steady, that is, the velocity is constant at any place, and the flow goes around the cylinder. However, the actual distribution of the lines is not like the lines of potential flow. They're solutions of a somewhat different equation. The equation, when the viscosity is very high, when the velocity is very low, when it's thick, like this is honey, the stuff is honey going by, then the inertial terms are negligible, and the equation that has to be solved is simply Laplacian omega equals zero, subject to the boundary conditions. And that equation can be solved, and that was solved by Stokes. Incidentally, for a sphere, there's a very important principle formula, which I might mention here, which is useful to memorize or to use. If you have a small sphere moving under such conditions of low Reynolds number, the force needed to drag it is equal to 6 pi eta times the radius of the sphere multiplied by the velocity of the sphere. This is a very important formula because it tells the speed at which tiny grains of dirt and whatnot, if they're spheres, will move through a fluid under a given force, the speed of centrifugation, sedimentation, and diffusion. As we have learned, there's a connection between the various things. But that's for a sphere. However, that's an aside. Let me get back to the cylinder. Now, if you increase the velocity further, this is a Reynolds, very small Reynolds number, let's say from 10 to the minus 5th to 1, or something like 1. If you increase it a little bit more than 1, you begin to discover that there's a back circulation here. So the question is whether there was always a back circulation here, even at the smallest Reynolds number, or whether at a certain Reynolds number things have suddenly changed. It used to be thought that they did it continuously. It is now thought that it suddenly changes, although I must say I'm not sure. In other words, we already have the first indication of a change in character, whether or not, the question is whether or not there's a back circulation behind the sphere which suddenly appears at a low Reynolds number. As the Reynolds number, however, certainly when the Reynolds number gets bigger than 1, there is no doubt about the back circulation being there. When the Reynolds number gets to be larger and larger, let's draw a picture, for instance, for 20 or something like that, then this region of back circulation gets bigger and bigger, and we have a circulating fluid that the fluid, of course, goes this way over the top, and then there's a region in which the fluid is not part of the mainstream, but simply circulates like an idler wheel in the back of the cylinder. That was shown in the next slide. See, it doesn't look like the potential flow at all. There is a Reynolds number, about probably 30 or 35, I suppose, in which we see the back circulation behind the cylinder. Now what happens if the flow gets even higher? Then suddenly there's a complete change in the character of the motion. What happens next is that this gets so long that it breaks off. And what happens is that the fluid curls around here and that curls around on the other side and so on in a series of vortices. That is, a whirlpool made on one side, then a whirlpool made on the other side, and a whirlpool made on one side and so on. An illustration of a picture taken here behind such an object. This sequence of vortices is called a vortex street. And a picture of such a thing is in the next slide. There is a series of vortices produced behind the cylinder. They peel off on one side and the other. As long as the Reynolds number exceeds 40. Now the difference between the two flows is almost a complete difference in regime. Here, at any point, the velocity is a constant. Here, at any point, the velocity varies with time. There is no steady solution above r equals 40. And so I have indicated this on this graph here, that from here to here, there's a complete change in the character. Here was steady flow, and here it varies in time, but in a regular fashion. Now, what happens next? As you go faster is very surprising, but it's interesting enough, that is here. We have here, as the speed gets higher and higher, what's actually happening is the following. There's no vorticity in the fluid here. It cannot get any vorticity except through diffusion. But due to the fact that the velocity must be zero at this surface, there is, of course, here, a tremendous difference in velocity, v equals zero here and finite here, so that there is a very rapid variation in velocity here. The vorticity then is created at the surface, always created at the surface, and moves into the fluid by diffusion. Now, when the velocity is slow enough, lots of it can diffuse in, and it can make a big band, a big area of vortex fluid, which has vorticity. But as the velocity gets higher and higher, there is less and less time for the vorticity to diffuse into the fluid. And what happens is that we get split off from here, a very tiny band in which the velocity is high here and low here, and which contains a tremendous amount of vorticity. So all the vorticity is confined into a band at this point, which then curls up and produces these things. Of course, it's diffusing slowly out, but it hasn't had time to go very far at the very high speeds. Let's say we're at Reynolds number closer to a hundred or so. But now as we get to Reynolds number 200, something funny happens. Far down inside this, there turns to be noise, irregular velocities, chaos, three-dimensional twistings. It's no longer two-dimensional flow, and it's no longer a regular kind of motion, but it's an irregular and chaotic motion. When we come to Reynolds number about 200, the chaos begins back in the deep parts of the so-called this shear layer here. This region here is called the boundary layer. It separates, actually slightly in front of the diameter of the cylinder. It leaves the cylinder at a plate. There's a backflow in here. And it leaves the cylinder at any point in which the pressure is increasing in this direction. As long as the pressure is decreasing down, it's all right. But the moment it starts to increase, the thing leaves the cylinder. Measurements of the velocity made by an instrument far down in the wake of the cylinder are indicated in the next slide. And you see the regular behavior for Reynolds number, approximately 80. This shouldn't be 8, this should be 80. On the next slide, we show a somewhat higher Reynolds number, and that indicates now it's 500, and you whether the top is 180, and there's the beginnings of some sort of irregularity, but not really noise. Lower down, there are slight noises from time to time, and then here's another circumstance, deep further down in the material, we find a very irregular and noisy velocity distribution. So suddenly, at Article 200, a new top thing happens. Irregularities, chaos begins in the back. Now, as the velocity increases still further, we go faster and faster. This chaos works its way up into this region and gets further and further forward. And at the same time, the chaos spreads so badly that the shape of the vortices, the picture which is so clean before, has become very noisy and very dirty. I'll illustrate that on the next slide of how the fluid looks at now a Reynolds number of 10 to the 4th. The Reynolds number of 10 to the 4th, that is the character of the flow. It actually isn't behind a cylinder but a blunt wedge. But it doesn't make much difference. It looks about the same. You see a chaotic motion, a noisy motion, but still containing some of the periodicities and wavinesses of the original vortex streak. Incidentally, the second there picture is an interesting one, because what has been put in here is a septum which separates the top from the bottom so that no liquid can flow from above to below, and you see the periodic thing becomes, of course, it's still noisy and chaotic, but it's a smoother flow. It's not that same wavy irregularity. Incidentally, that wavy irregularity and shedding of vortices on either side means, as the velocity is high enough, means that there turns out to be forces up and then down alternately on such a cylinder. And it must be held in place. Or if it's a telephone wire strung in the air, then as the wind blows by, it's driven up and down and sings, you know, on account of this. Children, you're too old to know to do it now, but you can tell your children someday to put rubber bands across their bicycles, handlebars, and when they go fast, the thing makes a noise. Now, that's how I learn all these things, you know. Now something else happened. Look, we're going along all right. We're up to 10 to the 4th. We're crawling along here. Remember, mind these are geometric proportions or factors of 10 in the Reynolds number. It's a log scale. But all of a sudden, something terrible happens here. Something else has to happen. What happens at higher speed? I'm changing only one parameter, r. What happens is that this irregularity works its way forward in the boundary layer until at a certain instant, at a certain speed r value, it reaches the point of separation. And then there's a complete change. Then the flow is changed to a flow that looks more like this. That is, the boundary layer adheres to a much, much better when it's turbulent already. In other words, the turbulence starts here, and we have what we call a turbulent boundary layer, and a turbulent boundary layer adheres better than the other. And because it adheres better and the flow is more completely like the potential flow, the forces are more perfectly balanced in front and back, and the drag suddenly decreases. In other words, you increase the speed, you decrease the force of resistance of the cylinder between Reynolds number of 10 to the 5th and 10 to the 6th. And the character of the flow suddenly jumps from here to here. What happens if we go still further? If we go still further, this seems to open out, the drag begins to increase, and the latest experiments indicate that there's new indications of periodicity in here, either because the whole wake is oscillating up and down, or that in some over or gross fashion, some new kind of vortex flow is occurring in this irregular and noisy fluid. The details are not known, and that's as far as we are able to go experimentally. I do not remember exactly what's on the slide, so I will have to look at them and see what I have to say. I think the next one, yes, this is the average. This is a time exposure picture of the flow at about 10 to the 4th Reynolds number, which I should have shown. It's a noisy business, but this is an average picture. The next picture shows the kind of wake of vorticity that appears behind a rapidly moving object, something like our cylinder, but in this case it happens to be a bullet going through the air. This is the noisy, turbulent fluid behind such a high-speed moving object. What's the next slide? No. All right. Now, I would like to make some remarks about this. In the first place, in every circumstance, as far as we know, we're solving the same equation. And all these different characteristics are simply that you change the value of R in the equation. I should like to mention that nowhere is the flow like the potential flow that we solved. We solved the case of the cylinder, but under no value of R is it correct. This at first sight might be surprising. After all, if viscosity eta is equal to zero, this term isn't here. Haven't we done it right? And so we think, what happens if eta is equal to zero? And we find R is infinity. Now, you'd be most surprised to think that this thing, which is getting more irregular and wavy and whatnot, is getting anywhere like the potential flow. And we've already gone up to 10 to the 7th. Certainly, you're not going to get there when we go to infinity. What happens then if you have a, how can it be that an equation in which you put R equals infinity so that this term is zero can give us a different solution than the one we obtained? The answer is very interesting. That is that here we have the coefficient, which is very small, times a second derivative. It's a higher derivative than any other derivative in the equation. And what happens is that although the coefficient is small, the thing makes a very rapid variation in space of the omega near the surface. And so the very rapid variation compensates the small coefficient, and there is no limit of the solution, as the solution hasn't got a limit as the coefficient goes to zero. You might ask, what is this turbulence and how does it maintain itself? How can the vorticity, which is generated somewhere at the edge of the cylinder, maintain so much noise in the background? And the answer is rather interesting. Vorticity has a tendency to amplify itself. Even if we forget about this for a moment, the diffusion, which is a loss of vorticity, consider this, that there's a lot of lines in a complicated flow. Imagine a material with a whole lot of lines in it, wires, and that I distort it and twist it like some kind of molasses. Then as you see that in general, no matter if you make a complicated enough distortion, lines that were simple before will get knotted and pulled close together. They'll be longer and tighter together. That is, the strength of the vorticity will increase, and its irregularities, the plus and minuses, will in general increase. So the magnitude of vorticity in three dimensions increases as we twist the fluid above, because the lines are getting tighter and twisted together. You might ask, when is the potential flow a satisfactory theory at all? In the first place, it's satisfactory outside here, where there's no, where the vorticity has not appreciably entered by diffusion. In the second place, by making special streamlined bodies, we can keep this region as being as small as possible, and the analysis of airplane wings and so on, which are carefully designed, is almost entirely through potential flow. Finally, you probably will challenge me and say, yes, so after all, you told me how a flow moves past a cylinder, but you also demonstrated in a previous lecture the flow past a cylinder with potassium permanganate and so on. We made a picture, and it looked like potential flow. What happened? The answer is that that was in a very thin layer, and the viscous force between the water and the glass is more important than anything else in that experiment, and that the law, the equation is false. It isn't this at all. The viscous effects are really a term effectively proportional to the velocity because of the problem of rubbing past the thin glass plates which are near each other, and then we cheated. So that it's not really the flow past a cylinder in three dimensions, but through an artificial situation that we were able to get the right looking solution. Now I must rush on to tell you, to convince that the fact, the behavior behind a cylinder is not special, but the behavior behind other, the behavior under other circumstances is very similar. And I have here a demonstration that Mr. Coles was kind enough to let me use to show this. We have solved the problem of the motion between two cylinders, and now we wish to see the solution work. If I turn the outer cylinder and not the inner, which I can do here, then nothing in particular happens. What's in here is oil with aluminum powder. And if the flow is complicated, you can see it because of the way that the aluminum powder arranges itself. If I turn the outer cylinder, nothing happens. But if I turn the inner cylinder, which it is now doing, but very slowly, nothing happens. But if I turn the inner cylinder faster, something happens. We'll wait until it happens. And while we're waiting, I hope it happens. Is it turning? Yeah. I'll describe this, that when we turn an outer cylinder, the solution that we obtained before is satisfactory. When we turn the inner cylinder, it no longer is satisfactory. Something new is happening. How could it be that there's a difference between turning the outer cylinder and turning the inner cylinder? Answer: look down upon the thing vertically. When we turn the outer cylinder, everything's all right. The fluid is moving here and is at rest here. If instead, according to what you like to think is relativity, but it is not relativity for rotation, remember, then it's the same as turning the inner cylinder and leaving the outer cylinder still, but it isn't the same, because now the fluid is moving here and not here. And there's centrifugal force. The fluid would like to lift itself to the outside because of the centrifugal force. And so it tries to do, it tries to lift itself up. If we look at the cylinder long ways now, here's the cylinder long ways, the fluid here is trying to go up, and the fluid here trying to come down. It's like hot air under cold air. And what happens is a general atmospheric circulation in which the water goes around this way in a bunch of cells. And so you see in the cross-section the cells here of the water, there's a circulation. As this is going this way, there's a circulation this way in the cell. Now let's see what happens if we speed the thing up still further. And now I turn it to a higher speed, bigger Reynolds number, turning the outer cylinder and leaving the inner one not turning. And you see that the original smooth cells have become wavy. There are waves around the circle now, 6 or 7 waves, and 28, 30, or 32, depending on the speed, cells vertically. The speed of the waves can be measured easily enough, and compared to the speed of the inside cylinder, the ratio of the two have been measured experimentally and are indicated in this slide. You notice that they're approaching the value 0.335. It's a challenge to figure out why. Obviously, the answer is 1/3, but no one has proved it. And there's a good problem for you. In fact, nobody really understands the waves. The circulating steady circulation of the little cells at a lower speed is understood pretty well. But the wave behavior is not very well understood. We still, however, are in the region of steady flow. Can we obtain irregular flow? If I speed the thing up still further, then you'll see that there's still cells, but there's an irregularity in the motion. So that now a turbulence type of motion has begun, but there's still some pattern in it. Other possibilities of turning the inside cylinder and turning both cylinders, one inside and one outside. And here we completely get there's a whole lot of other ranges of velocities which have all been studied. I haven't time to demonstrate all the different combinations, but here's a new kind of combination in which we have, if you can see it, a region of disturbed fluid followed by a region of calm fluid followed by a region of disturbed fluid. The region of disturbed fluid is in the form of a spiral, something like a barber pole, and between the disturbed or turbulent fluid and the calmer fluid, there's there's a disturbed fluid, the turbulent fluid, and a calm fluid both going around. You can see the disturbances and the calm fluid when you put the light behind it. So you see, I haven't got the time to describe in detail all of the very interesting regimes of flow with a very simple problem. The same mathematical equation above this line, a slight difference. V is equal to one value at the outer radius and it's equal to another at the inner radius. Solve, and you'll get all this terrible complications and irregularities. Again, we must see that we obtain a combination of steady flow, then a regular flow, and then irregular flow. You can remember the whole thing. It's all contained in one phenomenon. If you've seen a cigarette in very quiet air sitting on an ashtray, then you find a smooth vertical column, which is the steady flow, followed further out by a series of rings. It's hard to draw. I can't draw, but they go like this in succession outside as the smoke begins to curl. And in this region, it's a regular kind of motion. And then beyond, there's a chaotic twisting and turning, which is the turbulence. And so in any flow, there seems to be, in all the cases, the same sequence of three possibilities. One point I would like to make now is to try to understand one feature, and that is why the fluid, in the case of something like the cylinder, can't simply go past like this, that the fluid flows and goes past and leaves this region here of high speed and here's a still rest. The answer is very simple. This region is unstable. I want to explain where the vortex shedding begins. This is unstable because suppose that a bump were to form. Then in this region here, the velocity would be higher over the bump because it's confined into a smaller space. A higher velocity means a lower pressure by the Bernoulli effect. And so when the bump is here, it has a lower pressure and the pressure of this is higher, the bump will be increased. So all irregularities will be increased. I do have some pictures of mathematical calculations that indicate this. This diagram illustrates all the different regions of the two velocities and the different kinds of behavior that's been obtained. The enormous numbers of experiments with this rotating cylinder that are involved here is hard to appreciate. In the next slide, I hope, I show the mathematical solution. If you start with a sheet of vortex sheet, so-called, those two things with a slight bump in them, and analyze on a numerical computer how it behaves as a function of time, you see the beginnings of the turning and twisting that produces the vortex street. Say the next slide shows two more steps in the calculation. Well, I think that the main lesson to be learned from all of this is the tremendous variety of behavior that may be hidden behind a simple set of equations. I must emphasize that this variety, steady flow, smooth time dependence, and chaotic, are all almost certainly the solutions of the same equation. Please, give me 5 minutes, huh? that there's solutions of the same equation for various values of R. There's no evidence at all that there are any terms missing from the equation. And the difficulties are only that we haven't got the mathematical powers to analyze it today, except in the small r limit. That's when it's all viscous, completely viscous. Because we've written an equation, which we have here, we have not removed from the flow of fluids its charm or its mystery or its surprises. If such variety is possible with a simple equation, with only one parameter, how much more is possible with more complex equations? Perhaps the fundamental equations that describe the swirling nebulae and the condensing and revolving and exploding stars and the galaxies are nothing more than the behavior of nearly pure hydrogen gas, probably obeying fundamentally a simple enough equation. Often people in some unjustified awe or fear of physics say, you can't write an equation for life, you know. Well, perhaps we can. As a matter of fact, we very possibly already have to sufficient approximation when we write this Schrodinger equation in quantum mechanics. Yet it's of no real consequence. For as we've just seen, the complexities of things can so easily and dramatically escape the simplicity of the equations which describe them that men have often concluded that nothing short of gods, not mere equations, are required to explain them. On this board, I've written the equations of water flow. From experiments, we find a set of concepts and approximations to discuss the solution. Vortex street, turbulent wakes, boundary layers. If we have similar equations in an unfamiliar situation for which we cannot experiment today, we try to solve the equations, which is very hard to do, and in a most primitive and halting and confused way, try to see what new qualitative features may come out. Or what new qualitative forms are a consequence in this that these equations generate. Our equations for the sun, for example, a ball of hydrogen gas, to our eyes, that is looking at the equations, describes the sun without sunspots, without the rice grain structure of the surface, no prominences, no corona. Yet all of these are really in the equations, we just haven't figured out how to get them out. The next great era of awakening of human intellect may well produce a method of understanding the qualitative content of equations. Today we cannot. Today we cannot see that the water flow equations, so-called Navier-Stokes equations, as a matter of fact, is here, that the Navier-Stokes equations contain such things as the barber pole of turbulence that we saw there. Today we cannot see whether Schrodinger's equation contains frogs, musical composers, or morality, and whether it can or whether gods are necessary is something we have no real way to answer today. And so we can still hold strong opinions either way. There are those who are going to be disappointed when no life is found on other planets. Not I. I want to be reminded and delighted and surprised once again through interplanetary explanation with the infinite variety and novelty of phenomena that nature is capable of generating from such simple principles. The test of science is its ability to predict. Had you never visited Earth, could you predict the thunderstorms, the volcanoes, the ocean waves, the aurora, and the colorful sunsets? A salutary lesson it will be when we learn of all that goes on each of those dead planets. Those 8 or 10 balls, each agglomerated from the same dust cloud, and each obeying exactly the same laws of physics. Thank you. Let's turn it on for him. You may play with it. It's going to be left here, and you can come and play with it this afternoon. This thing will be here to play with this afternoon.
What do you mean when you say that it's in the equations, but we can't see it?
Because the equations describe the phenomenon. If we could solve the equations, we're not absolutely sure, but there's no evidence that they're the wrong equation. There's no evidence that any of these things are disobey the equation. It's just that we can't solve the equation, and we see the phenomenon. Now, we can make lots of checks. You see, you can argue what the equation means. You can check conservation of energy. You can argue about the inertia. You can talk about how the vorticity diffuses. You can understand the certain details, the instability of the straight flow, the tendency to curl up. You saw the pictures, the indications, but you have never solved the complete thing. So we don't really know that these are sufficient equations, but we have no indication that they're not. I wanted to emphasize that point, that as far as I can tell, that's all there really is to it. The fact is that the solutions are enormously complicated and we haven't got it. And what I wanted to emphasize is that having the equation and understanding the phenomena are two different things. That's usually not appreciated because we do so many problems that we can solve all the time. That was the main point. And in fact, in general, it's true. In more real situations,
we're going to get some more information about vortex.
You can come and play with it, and you can read all about it, or you can visit Mr. Cole, who will be very glad to tell you about it. He's anxious, in fact, to tell you about it in Carmen Laboratory. He's the man who sent it over here. He's the man in the brown suit. You can ask him directly. Yes, sir.
Do you really feel that all the turbulence and all the solutions that we see in experimental physics lie in those equations?
Yes, sir.
And that there may not be an addition?
Of course, there may be, but there's no indication that there is. You see, that because only for people who don't, as long as you don't know and can solve, then you can never be sure.
Yeah, but mustn't you leave yourself open?
Yes and no. You see, if you leave yourself completely open, then you make no progress. You must have an opinion to get rid of it. Let's make a hypothesis. I'll tell you, let me put it this way. They could all have come from this equation, as far as we know. We've never been able to show these equations will not produce any of those phenomena. And in fact, we can study a whole lot of details, like the width of the boundary layer as it grows around the little parts of the motion. And every one of those things works according to the analyses that come from these equations, conservation of momentum, the viscous forces, the rate of decrease. No, certain things you can measure. For example, you see, when you have measurements, you can do something. You want to test this, so you can take the average on, suppose you talk deep in the turbulent wake, that it says that the average value of the vorticity differentiated is equal to the curl of the average value of omega cross v, right? And that's the Laplacian of the average value of omega. Well, you could measure the average value of omega. I mean, with a pair of little wires that measures velocity differences and so on, you can measure all these averages and mean squares by putting two circuits that one measures the velocity and one that measures omega and average and so on. And all such checks agree with the equation. Nobody's ever found anything wrong with it. And just because it produces something you don't expect, it's only the prejudice that comes from solving simple equations simple situations that make, no, we don't know for sure. No, we don't know for sure. We don't know for sure. I didn't say we did. I said probably, but almost certainly, as far as we can tell. It certainly hasn't been disproved yet. And it has been proved again and again. Things, for example, another case where it's a little easier to control is the flow of water through a pipe. At low velocities, it's nice and smooth and regular. Above a certain velocity, the turbulence begins. You can figure when the turbulence should begin by looking at when the solution's unstable. You can also figure out when this thing should make a transition from the steady case, which can be analyzed easily, to the unsteady case by looking for instability. And an instability starts when it should, and so on, within the accuracy of either the analysis. There are many checks. Hydrodynamics has been studied theoretically with great detail, but you can't simply start out and find the pattern of those vortices or know exactly. You're surprised all the time because you can't solve it, but I don't think that it's because the equation is wrong. It's been suggested by many people that the equation is wrong, and they've been debating it for years just for the same reason, but most people who work with it have concluded that it's not that.
Do you feel that perhaps get into something like the quantum mechanical aspects of nature, even deeper than quantum mechanics, there's bound to be something after that.
Well, that's the question of finding the equations. You see, there's two aspects of it, I think, and that I was trying to emphasize today, which is a different view. One is to find the equation, but even having found the equation, you don't know what's going to happen. Here, I think we found the equations, and we had them for 100 years, but we don't know what the hell they're going to do in a situation as simple. You ask a problem,
You got a cylinder, you got a flow, what happens? Even easier, you got a pipe and a pressure difference, what happens? How much pressure do you need to drive the water through the pipe? You can't answer.
We don't know how to solve the equation.
That's right. I believe that's right. We were just discussing whether maybe the equations are wrong, but there's no indication of that. I mean, the difficulties, the peculiar motion is in there already. Such peculiarities and such irregularities are there. You can't show they're inconsistent. So very likely, they're actual. Well, I say it's consistent always. That is, if you make any kind of experimental check, like measuring the averages or something like that, which you can measure.
You don't know these.
No, you don't know. No, you don't know, but there's no disproof, and there's no reason to think they're not.
It raises an interesting question.
Except to keep your mind open. But it's better sometimes not to. I mean, until you're finished. If you could prove that it wasn't, that is a challenge. You see, people keep getting mistaken about this open mind business. If your mind is too open, you don't discover anything because you're not willing to make a hypothesis. Now, here's a hypothesis, a guess. That these equations completely describe the flow of fluids. Now you look at the flow of fluids. Do they or don't they? So far, nobody has disproved the hypothesis. Still, nobody has proved that it's true because you can't solve it. But at the moment, it's a useful hypothesis. Analogous to the hypothesis in biology that all the behavior of cells is through physical chemical phenomena of atoms that obey the physical laws. No one has disproved it. You can't prove it because you can't solve it, but so far, so good. Now, maybe like we'll find out that there's something else later.
It's an interesting question whether some of the equations you feel that we have solved completely.
Yes, exactly.
Perhaps,
of course, that's the point of raising this.
Yes,
exactly.
Contain hidden solutions
precisely.
That we haven't been able to observe experimentally.
Exactly, precisely, sir. Yes, sir. That's one of the points. You are learning. You are learning. That's what the purpose of such a lecture was, really. I mean, to get some idea, you know. Instead of just talking about the solution of a thing with the viscous this and that, like in the book, I want to make. I know it's a lot hard. I mean, I know the equations look complicated, but it's the idea of the.
Your reverse effect of switching charges, you know, the reverse time business.
Yeah, that was
that
a surprise.
Because it's a hidden solution in a way.
In a way, yeah, and it works still. Yeah. All right.
Fascinating.
Okay, but the subject fascinates me anyway.
Look at the difference between that and elasticity.
That's obvious.
Yeah. Elastic. I've come to the conclusion elasticity is an uninteresting
thing. Pretty dead, isn't it?
Yeah. Except for one thing. Did we come to any conclusions about the metal of the spaghetti? Was it meaningful?
I think it has to do with the fact that